A royal bombshell, courtesy of disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. Today, one of Epstein's accusers filed a lawsuit against Prince Andrew, Queen Elizabeth's third born, alleging Epstein loaned her out to the prince for sex against her will. Then, allegations of conduct unbecoming a governor. Days after going to the police, an aide to Andrew Cuomo goes public. And one of Chicago's finest gunned down in the line of duty as the city mourns Officer Ella French. You'll meet the former cop who trained her tonight on Banfield. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Banfield. Wow. I don't know if you saw this headline today, but it screamed pretty loud in America, and it screamed so loud in America, they heard it in England. Because the ugliness of the Jeffrey Epstein investigation is about to rain down hell on his best friends, at least one of them anyway. One of his victims, Virginia Giuffre, has filed a bombshell lawsuit in New York court today against the Queen's third son, Prince Andrew. Virginia Giuffre says that Epstein just lent her out. Yes, lent her out sexually to his good pal, the prince, trafficking her when she was only 17. And not just to Andrew, but to a bunch of other famous friends as well. Giuffre is alleging that she was forced to have sex with the prince three different times in three different countries between 1999 and 2002. In a London apartment, also in Epstein's mansion in New York City, and on Epstein's private Caribbean island. So that's a lot of trouble. I'm joined now by Josh Schiffer, whose firm has represented a victim in litigation involving Jeffrey Epstein's estate in the Virgin Islands, and also royal watcher Hillary Fordich. Thank you both for joining me. So Josh, let's just get right to the nitty gritty. Now there's officially a suit against Prince Andrew in New York. What does that mean for His Royal Highness?
This is huge breaking news. Mr. Boies's firm has been working on addressing the complaints by Ms. Giuffre for several years now and has reached out many, many times to His Royal Highness in order to address these really serious and colorable accusations of sexual assault and the injuries that flowed from that. And the response was nothing. As recently as a couple of weeks ago, they were in contact saying, listen, if you don't respond to us, you're forcing us to bring a suit against His Highness. And that's what has taken place. You can't just ignore the United States criminal justice and civil justice system, especially when there are allegations that seem to have so much proof behind them that are of such serious nature. This is really awful stuff. And without filing this suit, Ms. Giuffre permanently would lose her ability to access our civil justice system. So she was forced to bring this suit in federal court in New York today.
Okay, so it's clear, though, that she has her complaints against the prince. Those are civil complaints. But what does that mean for Prince Andrew when it comes to the criminal system? Does it make things easier? Does it change the metric?
You know, I think it's just overly complicated calculus right now. It's extraordinarily unlikely that any prosecuting agency would be able to bring active claims. There are statute of limitations issues. There's jurisdictional issues. There's also intergovernmental immunity issues when it comes to the criminal end. So this really, I believe, is the best avenue or remedy for Ms. Giuffre to follow. She isn't going to get any relief, requested relief from a criminal prosecution, and therefore the civil action is her only option. And she had to bring that civil action before New York State's special extended statute of limitations was going to close. And that was coming up here really quickly.
Okay. I'll tell you what, Josh, I'm so fascinated with all of these things, but I get even more fascinated with evidence, right? Because so often we just categorize these as he said, she said, but there's some very good meat in this. And I just want to play something if I can. This was Prince Andrew, who was interviewed by the BBC in 2019 and asked specifically about his relationship with Virginia Giuffre. So I want to ask our control room to roll this moment from the interview where he talks about his accuser, effectively saying, yeah, don't even remember meeting her. I really don't know who this is. Have a look.
One of Epstein's accusers, Virginia Roberts, has made allegations against you. She says she met you in 2001. She says she dined with you, danced with you at Tramp nightclub in London. She went on to have sex with you in a house in Belgravia belonging to Ghislaine Maxwell, your friend. Your response?
I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady. None whatsoever.
You don't remember meeting her?
No.
So, Josh, it's fine to say that to an interviewer. It's another thing to say it under oath if you end up under oath. And then a picture confronts you where you have your hand around a 17-year-old's bare midriff. Let's show the photograph. And it just so happens to be a photograph where the prince has his hand on Virginia Giuffre's bare midriff at 17 years old. And just look at that, who's in the background. Peek carefully at that face in the background. That's Ghislaine Maxwell, who's also facing criminal charges involved in this whole sordid affair. So tell me what that kind of evidence put together says if he ends up in front of a jury.
Well, it really is the squeeze, and it's terrible optics. I'm a 45-year-old guy. I don't sidle up to 17-year-old girls and wrap my arms around them, especially not in the setting surrounded by people like Miss Maxwell and Mr. Epstein, who were well known for the kind of lifestyle that they lived. This fits in with a party prince idea, not anything respectable, not anything that really they wanted to bring home to England and show. It's just inappropriate once you know all of the circumstances surrounding how and when that photograph got taken. Then to deny it, it really boggles the mind. Sure, he meets a lot of people, but these aren't allegations about meeting someone. These are highly intimate, specific acts. There's been corroboration presented. There's been an enormous amount of evidence. And this is going to feed into Miss Maxwell's case, who is facing criminal charges. And you darn well know questions about her relationship with celebrities and royalty are going to be germane to that criminal prosecution. It's all coming to a head sooner rather than later. There's no more running.
So Hilary Fordich, now that we've sort of laid out all the ugliness that is officially filed in court, how does this play out in a palace where protocol like shaking your hand properly can be catastrophic?
Well, pleasure to be back with you, Ashley. And you're absolutely right. This is ghastly any way you turn. This is a lose-lose situation. It's purported that Prince Andrew obviously has not responded to these. Josh is right that there's been absolutely no response. And that was because, of course, if he did, he would lose-lose because he would be dignifying the very accusations that he's tried to avoid. You played part of that interview from the BBC. What he continued on with and went on to say was the very night that he was supposed to have been in a location with her, he was actually with his daughters at a Pizza Hut in Woking in England. And I remember that vividly because that's where I was born. And he actually made a big point about saying that he never goes to Woking. So he was very adamant about exactly where he was on that exact night. And yes, this has been a disaster. The photographs you're currently showing are of him next to the Queen. And of course, he has stepped down, though, now from all of his royal duties because the charities that he was involved with, of course, wanted to distance themselves from him, which is of no surprise. But some very silly mistakes he made after Jeffrey Epstein was convicted. He still invited him to an event that was called the Dance of the Decades. And it was a big bash at Windsor Castle, and it was conducted for his 40th birthday party and also celebrating Princess Anne's 50th birthday party and actually Prince William's 18th birthday party. So he was there at Windsor Castle, invited Jeffrey Epstein, which was a rather silly thing to do of anybody who's been convicted. And he also went on to invite him to Sandringham and a number of shooting parties at different royal residences, which again can be considered rather inappropriate.
Yeah, I remember a New York Post cover where the Queen, and this would be sort of me paraphrasing the headline, was apoplectic about a walk in the park, literally in Central Park, with Epstein and Prince Andrew. So I think that really begs the question, Hillary. The royals have deep pockets. The royals have no patience for anything, like I said, beyond a handshake gone bad. Does that mean it is highly likely that there might be a settlement? Because that is also extremely loud and ugly.
Yes, a settlement. As I mentioned, actually, you're absolutely right. Either way, this is a lose-lose situation. There could be a settlement. I'm not a lawyer like Josh, so that's not for me to say. But what I would say is there's a great irony. Both of these stories, actually, that you started the show with actually are conflated because it was actually, ironically, Cuomo who actually signed into law on Valentine's Day in 2019, the very law that extended this ability for her to file this lawsuit. But going back to the royals and your point, the royal family loses either way. Just the very lawsuit in of itself is a dreadful, ghastly stain on the royal family. And Prince Andrew has brought this down upon his mother and upon the royal family, knowingly, willingly. However, of course, one is innocent until proven guilty, and he has not currently admitted to anything. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, but still it's not yet proven. That's all I should say.
Right. That's important because he has denied so much. I mean, he even denied knowing her, but the photo obviously, disabuses us of that. So, Josh, jump in where Hillary just mentioned, the part that you're the lawyer. This is critical. The suit was filed in federal court in Manhattan based on the Child Victims Act. Can he be compelled to cross the pond and sit for a deposition?
The compelling portion would be interesting to see exactly how they would try to effectuate that. There may be specific international treaties that would govern the ability to civilly sue a sitting head of government, along with just the tradition and decorum of the court. The courts are want to give a lot of deference to world leaders, but at the same time, our federal courts are where American citizens are allowed to lodge complaints against international figures. And very clearly, Prince Andrew and his representatives have refused to participate in a valid contest forum of the court system to even negotiate this. And that's because, just like Hillary says, this is a lose-lose for the royal family no matter what happens. Every day that the people of the United Kingdom are seeing this kind of behavior in the royal family, it's a stain. And the royal family doesn't have the luxury of Queen Victoria's time to sit back with a lot of comfort and security. This is a monarchy that is under threat regularly for its very existence. And this can't be a good look.
I'm so curious.
It would be absolutely amazing to see if they brought him here.
About Ghislaine Maxwell's case and what kind of squeeze information is going to come out about all these other rumored big shots who may be shaking in their boots right now. But boy, is this ever telling in terms of, next level big shot. Hillary Fordich and Josh Schiffer, thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Still to come. Executive Assistant Number One. What a name. Well, that's how she was referred to in that scathing report from New York's Attorney General. But now she's telling us her real name, and she's showing her face, and she's bringing her explosive allegations against Governor Andrew Cuomo to the airwaves. Wow, what detail. And does she have the receipts? Now, there's a question. I'll be joined by former top deputy to Whitewater Prosecutor Kenneth Starr right after this. Welcome back. It has been less than a week since the New York State Attorney rolled out her exhaustive report alleging a pattern of sexual harassment on the part of one Governor Andrew Cuomo. And safe to say that Cuomo has appeared more legally and politically imperiled and surely more isolated each and every day since. Today, members of the New York State Assembly began making plans for what seems like an imminent impeachment. But even that, yes, that, which is pretty big, was eclipsed by a network TV interview with one of Cuomo's accusers, the only one so far who has filed an actual criminal complaint. That loud name, criminal, is the one that gets headlines. You're going to hear excerpts from it in a moment, but I want to introduce you to my guests. Karen Hinton served as Governor Cuomo's press aide when he was housing secretary under President Clinton from 1997 to 2001. She says that he acted inappropriately towards her as well. Stephen Binnock is a trial attorney and a former federal prosecutor and former top aide to Ken Starr, the prosecutor who certainly did a deep dive into what President Clinton did to Monica Lewinsky. So, wow, perfect voices to talk through this one. First and foremost, legally speaking, I think it's really important, Stephen Binnock, to just outline in layperson's terms the governor's exposure, given what Brittany Commisso, the aide who's filed the criminal complaint, made very public today.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me. I think that under New York law, there are two criminal statutes, both misdemeanors, and they essentially make it illegal for anyone to touch or grope or grab a person with in their sexual parts, as it's defined under the law, with the intent to create personal gratification. So if you have a witness like we have today, and the prosecutor and ultimately a jury or a judge finds that witness to be credible, then it would seem to me that you are past the hurdle of proving the elements of that crime, both
so
those crimes.
Let's talk about credibility, because, you know, I've been in this business a long time, and I've seen a lot of women come forward and make accusations, and sometimes I've seen hundreds, but apparently hundreds of voices doesn't amount to much. It's just she said against he. But in this particular case, I think it's changing. Me Too has happened. We've had a lot of incidents with Cosby, which have left people, you know, less than happy. Harvey Weinstein, and many others. And so to that end, I want to play something that this aide to Governor Cuomo said on CBS this morning, because I think it speaks a lot to her memory, her credibility, her detail. It's very important. Brittany Commisso spoke with CBS this morning and really gave an account of what she said actually happened in the governor's mansion. Have a look.
He gets up and he goes to give me a hug. And I could tell immediately when he hugged me, it was in a probably the most sexually aggressive manner than any of the other hugs that he had given me. It was then that I said, you know, Governor, you know, my words were, you're going to get us in trouble. And I thought to myself, that probably wasn't the best thing to say. But at that time, I was so afraid that one of the mansion staff, that they were going to come up and see this and think, oh, you know, is that what she comes here for? And that's not what I came there for, and that's not who I am. And I was terrified of that. And when I said that, he walked over, shut the door so hard to the point where I thought, for sure, someone downstairs must think, they must think if they heard that, what is going on? Came back to me, and that's when he put his hand up my blouse and cupped my breast over my bra. I exactly remember looking down, seeing his hand, which is a large hand, thinking to myself, oh my God, this is happening. It happened so quick. He didn't say anything. When I stopped it, he just pulled away and walked away.
So it's important to break a lot of that story down. And when it comes to that, Stephen Binnock, the receipts matter. Contemporaneous reporting, photographic evidence that lines up with some of the stories, phone calls, key fob entries, other people's testimony, and the list goes on. Is that really what we're looking at now? Is that the deep dive that will be done, assuming that there is going to be a deep dive done by the state to look into this?
Well, I think yes, but I think first you really have to start with the witness herself, in this case herself. It's a detailed story. It's a poignant story. It's not overstated. It's clear. And so it's a very compelling story. And anybody who sees it, I think, has to take it extremely seriously. The thing to bear in mind, though, is that in our legal system, we have an antagonistic legal system, and the defense gets an opportunity to cross-examine. And so we really haven't seen a cross-examination here. So it's hard to say that we've really fully tested the evidence, but it's pretty compelling. Once you get past the original statement, then yes, of course. Now you want to see, are there other witnesses who saw it? Did people hear that door slam? Did people see her come up to the mansion and leave? Did she speak to other people afterwards and recount the event? There are a number of things that she might have done herself or other people would have seen contemporaneously that could bolster the case. And then you get to documentary evidence. Were there emails? Did she email a friend immediately afterwards? Were there records of who came and left the mansion? Was there video of who came and left the governor's residence? So there are a lot of things that you can look at to really parse through whether someone's telling the truth and whether what's corroborated and what's not. And you can see the defense already taking issue with some of the timeline.
Yes, of course, putting out statements saying, listen, the dates don't line up, the assignments don't line up. There was a pretty hearty pushback from the governor's lawyers. Karen Hinton, you know, I have covered so many cases where pattern evidence comes in. Phil Spector, five people testified that the same thing happened to them. The sixth woman died. But then Bill Cosby's pattern evidence was kind of a real disaster, shall I say. But when it comes to pattern evidence, you sort of have it. Maybe you'll be a part of the case, maybe you won't be, but you'd certainly say it on television.
Yes, I did. And, you know, I'm from an older generation than the 11 women who have spoken up about Governor Cuomo's behavior. And, you know, watching Brittany Camoso speak today, it just made me realize I really should have spoken up sooner. Praise to her for doing so now. And we can talk about doors slamming or not slamming. We can talk about confusion about dates or timing and all of that. But it really comes down to what happened behind that closed door and what happened in terms of what she said. And too often in sexual harassment cases, we don't believe the woman. That's been the case for decades. That needs to stop. We need to start believing the women who have spoken up about the governor. There are 11 of them. It shows a pattern. And certainly I know about the pattern myself based on something that happened to me in 2000. That was a different time when it was very hard for women to speak up, even harder than it is today, out of fear of losing their jobs, out of fear of hurting their careers. And that still is the case today. So there needs to be some really serious work at changing the way we react to sexual harassment cases. And I believe, based on the report that the Attorney General released, that we're making a move in that direction. I'm hoping that other attorney generals will take the lead from Tish James and will start implementing the sexual harassment cases, legal bills, legislation that they have in place now, and start enforcing them so that women who file sexual harassment cases are taken seriously.
When we come back after the break, Karen, I want to ask you exactly what it was that happened to you two decades ago and dig in a little bit on that and whether it is similar to some of the things that Brittany Camoso has said. And then we're also going to talk about the ins and outs of impeachment. New York doesn't have a lot of practice, and the rules might surprise you. Back after this. Welcome back. We're talking sexual misconduct claims, criminal investigations, and potential impeachment, all facing New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. My guests are Karen Hinton, Cuomo's former press aide when he was HUD secretary at the turn of the century, and former federal prosecutor and veteran of the Clinton-Lewinsky incident, Stephen Benach. Thank you again for sticking around to the two of you. Karen, just before I went to break, I wanted to mention, you know, it's important to outline what it was that happened to you when you worked with the governor, just to compare if this has been a pattern. Not saying it'll be in court, but it is fascinating.
In 2000, I was his press secretary at HUD, and we had an event in Los Angeles, a media event in Los Angeles, and I was there with him and other staff. And at the end of the day, he called me in my hotel room where everyone was staying and asked me to come up and chat. And I assumed it was to talk about the day and what we had done and what we would do the next day. So I went up to his room, and I'd been in hotel rooms with him before, alone and with other staff. So I wasn't surprised by that. But when I walked in, the lights had been dimmed, and I found that odd. We sat down on separate couches and had our discussion about the day's event. And then he moved into a more personal conversation about our marriages, his marriage and mine. And I found that uncomfortable. And I was certainly willing to talk a little bit about my personal life, but not that much. And I decided I wanted to leave. So I got up and I said, well, we need to get up early. So I'll see you tomorrow. He walked over and embraced me. And it was a very physical embrace. I could tell that he was aroused. And I pushed back and said, look, we need to get some sleep. I'll see you in the morning. And he pulled me back. And then I said, yeah, no, I really have to go. And so I walked out. And we never talked about it again. I never raised it with him or anyone on the staff. I did call a girlfriend that evening and told her about it, but I didn't tell a lot of people. And for the reason that many of the 11 women have already told the attorney general, which is you just have a fear of being fired, not being able to get another job, having some kind of retaliation. And that was certainly something I saw in him as long as I'd worked for him, which by that time was about 5 years.
And I will say, you know, in fair reporting that the Washington Post reported that the director of communications for the governor, Peter Ajamian, I might not be pronouncing that properly, says that these are untrue, it never happened, that these are old allegations from 21 years ago. But I'm fascinated, especially with the pattern issue, and maybe at this point, Stephen Binnock, you can jump back in on this conversation. There may not be pattern evidence. This may never go to court. It depends on what the prosecutors decide to do. They get cases like this all the time, and they can't treat him any differently than anyone else when it comes to the evidence in the case at hand. However, impeachment might be different. Lots of stories can get into impeachment that may not get into a criminal court of law. So talk to me a little bit about Karen's story, the 11 accusers, all the different stories, all the different women who have made accusations, and how that might make its way into a trial of a different kind.
Okay, well, remember, impeachment is a political action. It is not a trial. And so there are no rules of evidence. There's no judge per se making rules about what can come in and what can't come in. And the trial is much more freewheeling than a criminal trial or a civil trial where it's very subscribed, prescribed the way things move forward. New York is a particularly interesting state because New York does not have a standard even for impeachment. In our federal constitution, the president or an impeachable officer has to commit impeachable offenses, high crimes and misdemeanors. The New York state constitution doesn't even have that standard. So it's a wide open standard. Also, there's a trial of impeachment, a trial court of impeachment, which would be the senators, and that would happen after the assembly voted, a majority of the assembly voted to start the trial, and that trial could be wide open. There's really no standard there. It's just that all seven justices of the highest court in New York, plus all the senators, sit. And of those 70, if you get 46 votes, the governor or any other judge or someone who's impeachable under New York state law would be removed from office after conviction. But before you even get there, you've got the hearings in the assembly. And in the assembly committee. And the assembly committee really has no boundaries on what they can investigate. And already this impeachment has three different issues quite beyond the allegations of sexual misconduct. There's the issues of whether there was obstruction of an investigation of a bridge, the Mario Cuomo Bridge, named after his father, and over the Hudson River, obstruction or false statements regarding COVID statistics at nursing homes, and other things. But the most incredible thing about impeachment in New York State, I think, in the way that it's different than the federal impeachment statute, is if the assembly votes to impeach Governor Cuomo, he will cease being the acting governor of New York, and the lieutenant governor of New York will take over. So no press conferences from the governor's podium, no wielding the powers of government. He will just be pushed aside. That's completely different than what we saw in the Clinton and the Trump impeachments, or any impeachment under federal law, which under the federal constitution, you do not get removed from office until after you're convicted.
Different. So, that's different. I mean, definitely than we've seen at the federal level. I think with all of the things that both of you have just outlined, this sort of shocking news today that his top aide, Melissa DeRosa, and some have said his top apologist or enabler, certainly his biggest supporters, stepped down as well. Maybe at least of his worries at this time. Thank you to both of you, Karen Hinton and Stephen Vinnick. It's nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, words that no police officer ever wants to hear.
Give me two officers down.
Two officers down, and one doesn't make it. After a break, we're going to remember Chicago police officer Ella French with the former cop who trained her. So while the backdrop looks like the same backdrop I have every night, I'm actually coming to you live out of Chicago tonight, and it's lovely to be here. However, tonight in this city, two brothers are locked up, and they're charged in the weekend shooting of two police officers on this city's southwest side. One officer remains in critical condition, but I am really glad to be able to say this. He is said to be slowly improving. I am not happy to say this, though. The other officer, Ella French, just 29 years old, 3 years on the force, died of her wounds early Sunday morning. This afternoon, her brother Andrew told our producers, Ella was one of the brightest lights on the planet. And that's a quote. I'm joined now by Rob Casale, former Chicago police officer, who says this death has hit him particularly hard. He trained Ella French when she joined the force, and he works now with the First Responders Wellness Center here in Chicago. Thank you for coming in and paying tribute to your colleague. Rob, every time a police officer falls, it is extraordinarily difficult for their family, obviously, for their force, obviously, and for a lot of the citizens, too. This one is hitting people especially hard. Tell me about your friend.
Well, Ella was one of our recruits the last 3 years I was on the police department. I was a trainer at the police academy. So we trained a lot of recruits, and we got to see a lot of faces throughout those years. It's hard to remember all of them, mm-hmm. but as you get through training all of them, they become almost like your children. You know, you've given them the tools, hopefully, to succeed out there, and given them, hopefully, as much as you can. Based on our experience as instructors, when I had got to the academy, I had almost 20 years on. So I really enjoyed giving back the experiences and the mistakes that I made, you know, so that others wouldn't make those same mistakes.
But you said this hits you particularly hard.
Sure, sure, because you train somebody and you just never want to see that happen. Yeah. Not just to anybody you train, but just to anybody in particular.
One of the surprising developments, I think, as a producer, we look at stories, we have to find video, we have to present these communications on television in some visual way. And there was a photo that really struck me as very different from a lot of fallen officers and the fallout among their colleagues. There were hundreds of officers in their flak vests lined up outside of the entrance to the emergency doorway. To the hospital. You can see the ambulance entrance. To me, that was extraordinary. Do you have any idea how this sort of happens? Like, how do they decide for this particular one that they're going to congregate in this way?
I think it's just something that is genuine, something that just feels right at the time, something emotional. And when people get emotional in times like this, one of the healthiest things to do is to be there for each other, you know, to interact with colleagues, to kind of put your arm around each other and, you know, console each other, as you can see on the pictures you're looking at right now. And that's the best thing that they could do at that point.
But when any police officer dies, that's what people, you know, that's what their colleagues want to do. Mm-hmm. When this officer died, they came to the ambulance entrance, and then they were on the seventh floor. Many more police officers were upstairs on the seventh floor consoling Ella's parents. Mm-hmm. And when the Chicago mayor, Lightfoot, came to the seventh floor, they turned their backs on her. Mm-hmm. This one's different.
This one is something that a lot of police officers have felt a lot of heartache, a lot of hate towards them this year, based on the events of the whole year. And I think it's really taken a toll on them. You know, some of the things I hear in therapy sessions from police officers is every call I'm challenged, every call somebody interferes with it. And some have gone home and have had issues with family members because of the job they do. So they feel very vilified. And for a police officer, for me and for most of the police officers that I worked with, this is a calling. So when somebody does that to your calling and throws you in the mix with everything else that's going on, that hurts.
Let me just ask you, you retired from the training that you were doing with Ella French, and you have started effectively a wellness center, counseling a lot of police officers. And here's my guess, and tell me if I'm wrong. Your business has exploded.
Yes. Dr. Carrie Steiner started the First Responders Wellness Center about 10 years ago. This past year, we've grown exponentially. We've gone from her and I and one other therapist to 8 therapists. Our offices have grown from a couple offices to 10 offices. And we're getting phone calls every day because a lot of people are hurting. And we're starting to make a little bit of a dent in the stigma regarding mental health and law enforcement. People mm-hmm. are starting to reach out, and people are starting to see the benefits of talking to a professional and getting help.
So 3 suspects, as I read the details, this was a pretty innocuous traffic stop. Mm-hmm. The 2 police officers, Ella French and her colleague, who's unnamed at this point, but thankfully getting better, get out of the car and immediately take fire. They return fire. One suspect is shot. He's okay. The other one, presumably his brother, is also in custody. And the woman who was with them, who took off, remained at large, was captured. So all 3 are in custody. Mm-hmm. But it's a big story in this community. And it's going to be real hard for these people to garner a lot of sympathy, given that one of these officers, I think she was shot in the head.
Yes.
The other officer also gravely injured.
Yes, that's Officer Carlos Yanez.
Carlos Yanez, yes. Thank you. This is going to be a hard case to prosecute in this community. Do you expect that we're going to have protests and we're going to have looting? Do you expect that we're going to have sympathy for these 2 officers, or will there be more sympathy for the perps?
I would hope that there would be sympathy for the officers. I would hope that there would be cooler heads prevailing. And I think that's all dependent on our city leaders to step up and keep the peace and say, hey, I think Mayor Lightfoot actually said, let's stop with the hate towards each other. Because that's what's going on right now. A lot of people are leading with their emotional mind and, you know, preaching a lot of hate on both sides, and that's just has to stop, and we have to start healing.
It's pretty tragic when you see a face like that police officer just a few years on the force, mm-hmm. gunned down in cold blood just on a traffic stop.
Yeah.
So, Rob Casale, thank you. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
I'm very sorry for the loss of one of your children, I guess, as
yes.
you call them,
yeah.
you know, who you trained, Ella
yeah.
French. Thank you for giving some spark of life back
thank
to her.
Thank you for letting us talk about it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. When we come back, I'm going to speak with a mother who knows all too well what this kind of loss is like, because she herself lost her very young daughter in 2016. It was her daughter's first day on the job with the Prince William County Police in Virginia. Still talking about the 29-year-old police officer in this city of Chicago, Ella French, who was gunned down over the weekend, killed in the line of duty, just 3 years on the job. Joining me now from New Hampshire is Sharon Gwendon. Sharon lost her daughter, Ashley, in 2016, and it was Ashley's first shift as a police officer in Prince William County, Virginia. Sharon, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I'm only assuming that having gone through what you've gone through, hearing the news of what happened here in Chicago must hit particularly hard.
That is very hard. Any death, when it comes to a police officer, you're reliving that all over again.
What happened to your daughter, Ashley?
Well, she was responding to a domestic call. her and two other officers. And when they arrived, they were met with gunfire. So she was shot several times, once in the shoulder and once in the hip. And the other two officers were shot as well.
And how did you receive the information that your daughter had passed?
Well, I didn't get a call that she had passed. The first call I received was from the Prince William County Police Department notifying me that Ashley was shot due to the domestic response that she had responded to that evening. And then shortly after, I got a knock on my front door from the Merrimack Police Department, you know, just to be there for support and to see if I needed anything while I wait for the outcome. And then I got the information from the Prince William County Police Department for the police or for the hospital where my daughter was taken. And I was told that, you know, her injuries, that, you know, she would be okay. She was shot in the shoulder. And I said, is she going to be okay? Will she survive? I was told yes. And then about maybe 15 minutes later, I got another visit from the Merrimack Police Department notifying me that somebody from the hospital wants to speak with me. And then that's when I was told that they couldn't save her, that she died on the operating table.
You gave a compelling victim's impact statement at the trial of your daughter's killer. What do you hope happens to those who are responsible for the killing of this police officer here in Chicago?
We need justice for the police department. We need, you know, for the police. There's not enough that is done for them, for what they do every day to protect the people of their communities. There needs to be stricter laws that really penalize the people that are terrorizing the police as well as killing them. They need to have stricter laws that put laws. Mm-hmm. They're too lenient right now. You know, and that's why they're shooting cops without any penalties. There's not enough. There is too lax. And it's very frustrating to see us, what I lost as my daughter, and for what I see every day when, you know, there's a police officer like this poor woman,
well,
you know.
I'm so sorry we have to meet under these circumstances. And my heart goes out to you and your family. Thank you for sharing the story of your daughter tonight. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And thank you to all of you as well for watching tonight. We'll see you back here in Chicago tomorrow night for Banfield.